The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. On March 28, 2007, the Korea Society co-sponsored a young professionals forum titled Investing in Korea with the Columbia Business School Asian Alumni Club of New York. Moderated by Professor Ronald Schramm of the Columbia Business School, a panel of experts discussed South Korea's current macro and microeconomics, perceptions that the country is becoming more hostile to foreign investment, and the regulatory and tax frameworks any investor should know before getting into the South Korean market. Panelists included Donald Hanna, Global Head of Emerging Markets at Citigroup, John Lee, a director at Lazard Asset Management, Eric Yoon, partner at the law firm of White & Chase, and Kaz Parsh, a senior manager of international tax services at Ernst & Young.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome, a warm welcome to the Korea Society on this delightful spring evening. Thank you all very, very much for coming. I'm Evans Revere, the new president of the Korea Society, and I am delighted to see all of you here this evening, and I am particularly delighted to see so many young or younger faces, I should say. I feel 20 years younger already just looking around at the crowd that we've assembled here this evening. I want to thank everybody who has made this evening possible, and there are many whose support I want to mention right off the bat. And, of course, to begin with, this program today, this evening, is made possible by our co-presenter, the Columbia Business School's Asian Alumni Club of New York, which is very well represented here tonight. We have also had the sponsorship of other good friends, including Merrill Lynch, the Korea Business Association of the Columbia Business School, and also Tiger Asia Management. And I want to thank all of you for helping make this wonderful evening possible. I should say right at the outset, noting the crowded conditions, that this is, I believe, the last large event we will do in this room. We are about to expand our turf, so to speak. We are virtually going to double our floor space, and so hopefully the next time that you come back here, you'll have a little bit more elbow room as you're in this room. We're going to expand not only this room, but our gallery space and our ability to put on some fairly large programs, and we're looking forward to that. Tonight is a particularly special occasion for me, not only because I get to welcome old friends of the Korea Society and new friends and guests, but also because it occurs to me in looking at the guest list this evening and introducing myself to a number of people a little bit earlier on, that we have some rather important audiences for the Korea Society here in attendance today. Those audiences include people from the business community. We have very, very strong and close ties with the business community in and around the New York area, and those are ties that we work very hard at maintaining and strengthening them, and that's a critical task for us ahead in this, the 50th anniversary year of the Korea Society. Also tonight, a wonderful gathering of young professionals, and that is another key target audience of the Korea Society. As dinosaurs like me pass from the scene, we are trying to reach out to the next generation of leaders, the next generation of leaders in business and the legal profession and banking and so many other endeavors, and we are delighted to see all of you here today. Other critical audiences are here tonight that mean a lot to us at the Korea Society, and that is, of course, Asian Americans, who are so wonderfully represented here tonight, and Korean Americans in particular, two key constituencies that I think ought to have a keen interest in what we do here at the Korea Society, and I think do have an interest based on what I've seen in terms of membership from the Korean American community and from the Asian American community in general. We are reaching out to all of these audiences and more. in this, our 50th anniversary year. We have some very big plans for the Korea Society, and before we begin the program, I just wanted to pause for a two-minute commercial break, if I might, to just let you know what some of those plans were and are. I've already alluded to one of them, expanding our spaces here. But we're going to be doing a lot more and a lot better programming in the months to come. In this room, just 2.5 short weeks ago, we had a very senior delegation from North Korea meeting with a group of eminent Americans, including Henry Kissinger and Madeleine Albright. We met for 5 hours in this room in a very intense and lengthy discussion of U.S. DPRK relations and U.S. relations with Northeast Asia. It was a most interesting program. That's the sort of thing that we want to be doing a lot more of in the months and years to come. We had the mayor of Gwangju here for a senior lunch just a couple of weeks ago, and he brought along a delegation that was very expert in the high-tech developments that are happening in and around Gwangju. It was the most interesting program. We've done programs recently, and we'll be doing a lot more on the Korean diaspora, a very hot and interesting and important topic. We just did one here the other night. We've done programs on Korean film, another hot topic, Hallyu, the Korean wave that so many of you have heard so much about. And we had a fascinating program the other night on photography, photographs taken by an American veteran who was stationed in Korea in 1953. And it was just an amazing insight into what Korea used to look like. And brought back some fond memories for many people in the room. We've taken the liberty of giving out a pamphlet, which I encourage you to have a look at, which details some of the things that we're doing on the culture and artistic front and some other areas. And please feel free to take that with you. There's a lot more to come beyond what I've suggested here. But all of the things that we want to do and that we're capable of doing are only going to happen with the support of the key constituencies, such as those represented here this evening. And we'll be reaching out to all of you for your support and for your membership in the Korea Society. I know a number of you here tonight are members, and we thank you for your support and your friendship and cooperation. Those of you who are not, I hope you'll take some time to pick up some of the literature that we have regarding membership. It's a fascinating organization. It's a unique organization in the United States, and we look forward to having you join us if you can. Let me also just point out the obvious, and I think this is a point that a number of our speakers will be making this evening, and that is Northeast Asia is an incredibly dynamic region of the world, politically, economically, culturally, and in so many other senses. It is a region of the world that is absolutely critical to America's future. And Korea, the Korean Peninsula, is right in the middle of that in more ways than one. And that's another reason why I think there is such keen interest in what we do here at the Korea Society. And obviously there's keen interest in this subject reflected by the fact that all of you are here tonight. Let me end my remarks by asking two of our key supporters and for this evening to step up and begin the next phase of this evening. I've gone on much too long, but I did want to say a few words of welcome to you all. I would like to invite Heidi Thompson, who of the Columbia Business School Asian Alumni Club, to come up to the mic and take it from here. Thank you.
Thank you, Evans. And I just want to say also thanks very much to all of the folks at the Korea Society. So Evans Revere, Carter Booth, Sophia Kong, and her team headed up by Patrick Clare have been incredibly wonderful to work with. And we thank them very much for their administrative support and for this lovely space and for being wonderful partners. And we also wanted to thank our sponsors for this evening, Merrill Lynch, which has a long history of partnership with the Korea Society, and also Tiger Asia Management and Mr. Bill Huang, a longtime investor in the Korean market and supporter of the Korean business community. And we also wanted to recognize the wonderfully dynamic student clubs at Columbia Business School. The Korean Business Association, under the leadership of Han Chung and Sean Bai, has been tremendously helpful in putting together this evening's program. And also the Asian Business Association, under the leadership of Jennifer Chow and Peter Lee, has also been a great pleasure to work with, and we hope that these students, now that they are soon graduating, will continue to be active in the Columbia Business School Asian Alumni Club. And that call goes out also to all alumni and friends in the Asian business community in New York who would like to be involved with programming involving issues in the Asian business community. We would love to work with you, and we look forward to many more successful programs. So my co-chair, Paulina Yik, and I are also wanting to thank very much our speakers for being here this evening. They're all distinguished professionals in their fields, and our moderator, Professor Schramm, represents the Columbia Business School. And once again, thanks to you all for coming. We're very excited that you're here. And Bonnie Graciano with Merrill Lynch will also say a few words. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you, Heidi. Hello, and annyeonghaseyo. My name is Bonnie Graziano, and I'm here representing Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch is extremely pleased to be a sponsor of this event. And I just wanted to say, on a personal level, that I've taken a special interest in investing in Korea because I happen to be half Korean. 나는 한국 사람, 미국 사람, 50-50. I hope I said that right. I was told there was another way to say it, but I don't remember it. My mother's Korean, and my father was an American GI, an MP, in post-war Korea. They were married at the American Embassy in Korea in 1964. On your seats, I placed a white folder, Merrill Lynch folder, with my card in it. And before I leave you to the rest of the program, I'd like to explain briefly what I do at Merrill Lynch, because I think financial advisor is a term that may not be well understood by everyone. In a nutshell, I help people get financially organized, and I help them make smart decisions with their money. And as a segue to the panel, and as a matter of practical application of tonight's topic, if you are interested in investing in Korea, you may call me if you would like. That's all. Thank you for coming.
And now I'd like to introduce the moderator of our panel, Professor Ronald Schramm, who has also the excellent good taste to have married a Korean lady, apart from his distinction in the field of finance.
Thank you, Heidi, Bonnie, and Evans. Whenever I fly into the airport in Nairobi and take the taxi to Nairobi, I'm always the first thing I see are signs of Samsung and Gold Star all the way in, completely in the way in, on the way into Nairobi. And when we lived in China, we watched television, of course, all the time. We were watching those Korean soap operas. And when I come back home to New York, I pick up my fruits at the local Korean deli and come home to a nice warm meal of bibimbap and kimchi, which my kind wife prepares. So it seems our lives are being surrounded by Koreans. I want to know what's going on, and that's why I'm here tonight, to learn a little bit about that. But seriously, if we just even look at Korea at, in the way it gets categorized by different institutions, the Morgan Stanley Capital Market Index still includes South Korea as an emerging market. And in that group, we have anyone from Peru to China. But then if you look at IMF or World Bank classifications, we have Korea falling under categories called newly industrialized Asian economies or other advanced economies. And then we have Korea 10 years ago or so joining the OECD, the Rich Man's Club. So we wonder where Korea is exactly, and I think our fine panelists tonight will help us fathom that question. Our first speaker is Donald Hanna, who is head of global emerging markets, global head of emerging markets at Citigroup. So without further ado, thank you.
I should say, for Truth in Advertising, all I'm responsible for is economics. So if you want the financial advice, there's many other people at Citigroup besides those at Merrill Lynch who might be able to help you. No more advertising, I promise. Okay. Let's get to the topic at hand, which is the Korean economy. That'll be helpful. Sorry. And you can see from the title, it says growing at cruising speed. In fact, Korea, I think, like a lot of emerging markets, if we look out over the next couple of years, is likely to see growth that's relatively close to what we've seen in the recent past, which luckily in Korea's case is quite good. Oops, and do that. You can see here the panel on the left is showing you GDP growth, measured in two fashions, one on the year-on-year basis, which is what's usually in the newspapers. And then there's the green line there, which is a seasonally adjusted annualized rate, which is, in fact, the way the U.S. growth numbers are done. And you can see both of those lines are converging, which is telling you, in fact, that the economy has been growing at roughly the same rate and continues to grow at roughly the same rate over the course of the last year or so, which is essentially 5%, which is where we think growth, if you could grow in Korea, over a long period of time, that's consistent essentially with not accelerating inflation, and given the resources that Korea has available to it. Now, while the overall growth rate has been relatively stable, if you look at the panel on the right, what you'll notice is that the composition of growth is between net exports, what Korea is selling to the rest of the world, net, and domestic demand has, in fact, been shifting. And you can see, for example, the blue line, which is net exports, has contributed next to nothing of late, whereas there's been a rise in domestic demand, largely consumption, and to some extent we think this year going forward investment, particularly in housing, that is contributing to that 5% growth. Now, part of the reason that growth has been relatively steady and fairly high at 5% is that you're getting steady growth in both wages and in overall employment, and that's also reflected in fairly steady consumer outlook. In fact, a lot of the debate that one sees at the macroeconomic level these days in Korea is about things like the housing prices in south of the river in Seoul, and not about big issues. Well, even the discussions, which I'll get to later on in the discussion about the won, have tended to diminish as the won itself has tended to stabilize. There is, however, as I mentioned, that composition between domestic demand and net exports has shifted, and part of that is because here in the United States, in the fourth quarter of this year, of last year rather, we had a decline in the import in business equipment investment, and particularly software and technology products. And of course, that continues to be an important element of what Korea exports to the rest of the world, and that's been affecting then the level of activity, particularly industrial activity, as you can see in the chart that's in front of you. The good news on this is if you look across Korea's exports or the exports, say, of Taiwan or China or Singapore in just the last couple of months, those tech export numbers look like they're actually beginning to improve. And despite, for example, this morning's bad numbers on durable goods, which would include technology to some degree, those bad numbers are actually because U.S. firms aren't ordering construction machinery. They are ordering technology products. Now, I mentioned that one of the issues that's out there in the macro picture is housing prices, and of course the government has been focusing on what to do about trying to control those housing prices. In fact, that's a big element of what's driving the monetary policy of the Bank of Korea these days, because inflation is relatively stable, so they're worrying about what can they do about these asset prices, can they do something to avoid a housing price bubble. And we'd argue actually that there's not that much. You can see these are the on the panel on the left is showing you how prices have actually performed. The red line is the overall level of home prices, which are up from 2003, I should say, they're up about 15%, which over a 2.5-year period is not that great a return. And in fact, seems to us to be have more to do with the relatively short supply than it does with a housing bubble per se, particularly in an environment in which, as I showed you earlier, wage growth is relatively strong and income growth has been relatively steady. And hence, what really needs to be done, rather than trying to jack up interest rates, is to, in fact, to increase the supply, but that's difficult in some of the more crowded areas of Seoul in which you've actually seen the biggest run-up in prices. So in some ways, what Seoul is facing is what one faces in New York City or a city like San Francisco or a city like Boston, which is simply people want to live there. There's a relatively short supply of land, and as a result, as the city gets richer and incomes rise, which is what's happening when you grow 5% in not real terms plus inflation of another few percent, housing prices simply rise, and you should not be confused actually with a bubble. What the government's likely to do about it, we think there again, part of this is associated with efforts at trying to increase housing supply and simplify the permitting process, which would allow then for an increase in the supply, which would moderate prices. The other issue that's out there is the yuan. Of course, in 2005 and 2006, as you can see on the chart that's on the left, you had a very rapid real appreciation of the yuan. If you think back to the chart I showed you earlier, that was actually in a period in which exports were quite strong. So it's not that this is weighted by the trade that Korea does with the rest of the world and the inflation indices in the rest of the world to get to the real exchange rate. But it doesn't, what it leaves out here, which is the critical element of the picture, is what's happening with productivity, right? Because one thing that your prices may be going up and your exchange rate may be getting stronger, but if your productivity is growing, you can afford, essentially, to continue to produce even with a stronger exchange rate, yeah? And even with your input prices rising, as has been reflected in the panel on the right there, which is showing you your terms of trade, where the input costs have been rising quite rapidly and depressing the terms of trade. A lot of that was higher oil prices, of course, which have tended to be stable until just the last few weeks when the Iranians decided to kidnap some UK Marines, which designed specifically, it seems, to raise oil. Not specifically, I'm being facetious, but certainly didn't do any good to the oil market with that action. Can we bring out the candles and the booze? Or it's not too dark. It's I don't want to put the audience to sleep. That's all. It's late in the day. Okay. The interesting issue going forward, there's two things on the one that I think are relevant here. Firstly, we firmly believe that on the basis of the strength that we've seen in the Chinese economy over the course of the last few months, the recovery after the slowdown, or moderation, I should say, in the fourth quarter, with Chinese growth picking up quite rapidly, the trade surplus, in fact, in the first 2 years hitting $40 billion, which is about a quarter of what was seen, in just 2 months, a quarter of what we saw in all of last year, that the Chinese are likely to see, to allow much more rapid, or not much more, but more rapid appreciation of the yuan. Okay, so that in that environment, then nominal appreciation of the yuan would be a little easier to absorb. Okay, it's also likely, we think, over the course of the next 12 months, though not so much in the near term, although potentially in the near term as well, for the Japanese yen to also strengthen. Yeah, in part because of the divergence between prospects for the Japanese economy on the one hand and the U.S. economy on the other, where the U.S. economy's prospects are somewhat more uncertain, particularly given what we've seen of late about the pace, the timing it will take to recover from the housing slowdown or from the housing excess here in the United States. So we're not too worried that the performance of yuan in nominal terms or real terms will be a drag on the economy. Going forward, though, it has, of course, been stronger. In fact, here's the actual forecast numbers. You can see there across the bottom. So there's a nominal appreciation on a 12-month horizon that's modest. We don't have any change in interest rates, again, because we don't see a big movement in inflation per se, and because growth looks like it's at potential. And that's true both at the short end and at the long end. So it should be a fairly stable investment environment in the near term macroeconomically for Korea. Are there risks out there? What people are talking about in Korea is concern in part about the run-up in indebtedness, particularly in household indebtedness. And if one sees a further deterioration in the terms of trade that begins to weaken the current account, then there's some concern that the combination of that higher indebtedness with a current account deficit may begin to pressure interest rates as if the central bank tries to rein in that credit and create an environment which could be potentially a little bit more uncertain. Here's the actual details of the forecast. The one thing I know about these numbers is that most of them are wrong. But the critical issue, I would argue, is that you have in the basis of a relatively stable performance going forward. I wanted to end with just a couple of comments about some key factors in terms of the macroeconomic environment generally to keep in mind. And one is that I think we're going to continue to see from the Korea, consistent with the view that inflation is going to moderate and growth will be relatively steady, that I would not expect to see a big diversification of, for example, Korean exchange holdings away from the dollar. I don't think that's actually in general going to happen across Asia, so I don't think that's something one would worry about, A. And B, I think you'll continue to see in the headlines this tension between the view of Korea as a center for particularly for Northeast Asian finance and growth on the one hand, and some nationalist pressures on the other with regard to foreign investment. And I think that simply reflects a tension that has been there for a long time, and in some sense not particularly new. And the big difference that we have between Korea today and Korea, say, 10 years ago when we were in the throes of the crisis, is that, in fact, you do have, by and large, a more arm's-length relationship between government on the one hand and business on the other, which is creating, in fact, greater discipline for the majority of companies. Yeah, and the difficulty that we run into at different points in time, of course, is the desire on the part of some bureaucrats to still have the same level of control that they would have had 10 or 15 years ago. So while many of the senior government officials see the benefit of having a more arm's-length relationship, when you go levels down, it still can be more complicated in trying to have those bureaucrats step back consistent with the policies that, in general, the government is trying to follow. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Don, for those very nice insights. And so we move from macro...
That says, don't believe anything I said. That's the disclosure. It goes on for three pages.
We move from macro to micro. I didn't mean micro quite in this sense, but more from macro to more micro topics. So our next speaker will be John Lee, director at Lazard Asset Management.
Thank you. Good evening. I was given the opportunities a few times to talk about the Korean economy and investing in Korea and stock ideas, but I have never seen a crowd like this. So it's, I'm so glad that finally we have so many people interested in investing in Korea. Looks like yesterday since I began my career investing in Korea. Since 1991, I began to manage the Korea Fund. At the time, the total size was about a little bit more than $100 million. But now it is about $1.4 billion after paying out all the dividend and taxes. So this is kind of the example of how Korea has grown. Many people, my friends, when I was running the Korea Fund, asked me which stocks to buy. So I said, simply told them, because so many people ask me about the stock ideas, I simply say, buy Samsung Electronics, buy Samsung Fire Marine, and that's it. And then it happened to be, this is a great investment. If you invested in 15 years ago, Samsung is 50 times, Samsung Fire Marine 100 times in 15 years. So what's next in Korea? There are any other opportunities, like another Samsung Fire Marine, something like that. So I think that Korea is still that providing a lot of opportunities. There are a lot of companies which has potentially to be another Samsung, another Samsung Fire Marine. There are many small companies have great potential. Especially, I have a strong belief in Korean people that the education and that more than 50% of disposable income is spending for educating their children. You cannot find many countries like that. And I was one of my nephews was graduating from Cornell, so I went to the graduation ceremony, and all the names of PhDs is Korean names, the Kim or Lee. So it's I was very fascinated that the Korea's potential, the future, is very bright. I don't get into too much detail in the numbers, but the outlook on Korea is very bright, I say. The brief comment on the Korean economy, that Korea is one of the top 10 the largest stock markets in the world. This is a little bit outdated. Now Korea is the 13th, simply because the Korea was the underperformed the market compared to others. Like India is growing fast, and the China, Taiwan. But that is good news, actually, so that Korea is more providing more value to investors. Unlike other countries, Korea is very well diversified industries. The Korea has been very successful moving from labor-intensive, capital-intensive industries, more technology-oriented, more knowledge-oriented, because the next generation, that they are much more diversified and they are more much more creative in their futures. It was fascinating. I was talking to college kids in Korea. The most of them, what are their plans? In my age, when I was going to school in Korea, the most of them that their future plan is going to join the chaebol companies. That is always the top priorities. But now, the young Korean graduates, they want to set up their another company, like they want to be Bill Gates. They want to set up their own company. This is great. I think they're much more diversified and much more creative. So I was very happy to hear that. And the valuation is cheap. The P multiple is 10 times. So relative to other markets, Korea provides much value. Overall, there's obvious every market has positives and negatives that I couldn't find many negatives, but people criticize me that because you are investing in Korea, so you have to be out there positive. But sincerely, I'm lucky that I'm investing in Korea, that the outlook of Korea is, from my view, that I have great confidence. Korea is now it's about to be a part of the developed market index. I don't know when it's going to happen, but given the industry and the market cap and the competitiveness, Korea, it will definitely be part of the developed market. And then there's another level up in share prices. I talk about this is the economy, but I don't want to get into too much in the economic side. I'm more like a bottom of the stock picker. The one thing I like to comment in the Korea economy is the China. There are many people worry about the China's evolving, that Korea is losing competitiveness because of cheap labor from China. I have a different view that, yeah, that's true, but China will become a big market for Korea. So China became already the number one trading partner with Korea. So I think that there will be much more benefits coming from China than negatives. So I have great hope that going future, that Korea will make a lot of money out of Chinese economy. North Korea relations, I don't know much about North Korea. It's very unpredictable, but I guess I'm cautiously optimistic on North Korea. And actually, one of my analysts went to North Korea visiting Kaesong, the Korean company having joint venture in Kaesong. It was fascinating. That it's just the beginning stage, but this is a really good sign that the Korean companies operating in North Korea. There's not many people know about that. And if the South Korean companies can utilize cheap labor, I guess is they are more disciplined than other countries, then there's another boost for Korean companies. I mentioned about the workforce, that Koreans spending a lot of money in educating children, and more than 50% of my friends, they are separated from their wives. That the wives in staying in U.S. for the children, and my friends staying alone in Korea. Their miserable life, but that's how serious that, you know, it's natural for Koreans, that for their education, they're willing to go the old way. So this is, I think that this, there are many, you know, the negatives coming out of that event, but the overall, the Koreans are, I have great hope that the Korean will succeed in going forward. Actually, one of my senior members in my organization asked me that he is so fascinated by Korean people that all the children of their grocery stores nearby, their children all go to Harvard or Yale. So, you know, not many countries like that. And another last point is the penetration rate in high-speed internet. That I think the Korea is the only country that all the housewives trading the stocks over the internet. That they are
familiarized.
And then options and options and futures too. So it's amazing the country that how fast they adopt new technologies. That Korea, after the experiencing economic crisis, one area that there is a huge progress, the minority shareholders' right. The laws has been changed in regulations, and Korea is very serious in improving corporate governance. It's a long way to go, but I think the Korea is in the right direction. And accounting practice, transparency. Comparing to 15 years ago, 10 years ago, the Koreans are very creative in accounting practices. But now they have much less freedom. One example, that this is a true story. I was a visiting company, and the company's revenue has been growing 40% per year, but net income stayed the same. So I was curious. I asked the CEO of the company, what's the problem that your revenue is growing very fast while your net income stays the same? He said, oh, that's our company policy. This is serious. So they didn't even know that what has to be, you know, they didn't have no clue. This is before the crisis. But after that, they realized the problem, and that the law has been changed. And actually, a lot of my background is accounting, by the way, and then many people, my friends, you know, working for a big accounting firm now is some, unfortunately, that, you know, had to go to jail for signing up a wrong statement. So the government is very serious that to make things happen, to make sure that the accountings are, accounting practices should be more transparent. And the companies in general, the Korean companies, they are much, much stronger. That debt equity ratio used to be 400%, but now it's around 100-150%. And they are very careful when they make investment decisions. Healthier banking system, that half of the Korean banks are now owned by foreign banks, and there are no more the policy banking from the MOFP or any government bodies, which is great news. Outlook, the valuation, I talked about it, is about 10 times North Korea. And the pension reform, the Korea is now changing the pension system from defined benefit to defined contributions. And they will grow very fast, and there will be a big demand for shares. Another thing, the low exposure in equities by individuals. The Korea, like Japan, is very low exposure in equities. About 6% equity exposure and more than 85% in bank deposit. Bank deposits, they didn't, usually they pay interest rate was more than 10%, but no longer possible. It has to be moved from bank deposit to equities. It's a matter of time, and this is already happening. And the long-term investment culture, usually the Koreans are very short-term oriented investing. Even the institutions, their turnover ratio is more than 1,000%, and individuals 5,000%. But now the culture has been changing. The more equity fund is developing, and institutionals are more participating in equities. If the long-term investment culture is developing, which is good, then the company, the individuals, the shareholders can raise voices to the management. I talked about the financials of companies. They are much stronger. In terms of negatives, that I couldn't find many, but one thing that that worries me is that after they overcome the economic crisis in 1997-98, the reform, they're very tired of reform. And the individuals, they need someone to blame. And so two things, one, government. The second, foreign investors. The foreign investors are making too much money out of Korean asset. So this is really worrisome. But it's not really the significant enough, but if this continue to build up, that could be a potential problem. And the corporate governance, it has been improving, but there's still the more room for improvement. There are all the laws and regulations in place, but no one is implementing it. So someone has to be involved in improving corporate governance. And the last one, the chaebols. Every government has said that they will reform chaebols, but all failed. Their influence is bigger and bigger. So there has to be some way to reform chaebol system. This is the chart showing that the relative to other countries, Korea's P multiple is about 10 times cheaper than any other countries in the globe. Especially in Asia. India, by the way, is 17 times. So Korea is providing much better value. The companies are very strong. I'm not talking about the company established 5 years ago. The company has been in the business for 40 years, 50 years. They are very strong, but the P multiple is very attractive. Price of book. Korea is 1.3 times. Obviously, it's much cheaper than other countries. I talked about the exposure by individuals. And the South Korea in the bottom, the equity portion is 6%, and 83% is a bank deposit. I love this chart that the individual will definitely will buy more equities. The pension. The percentage of GDP at Korea is the bottom of the list. It is growing very fast. And also the pension, the exposure to equities is very minor, that about 10%. The government is trying to be trying to make it higher, up to 25% in 2 years' time. And the total pension is expected to be about $300 billion within 3 years. And a big chunk of money will be investing in equities to make a Korea market more brighter. Now the local investors, individuals, they begin to buy the fund rather than investing by themselves. And the equity type fund has growing very, very fast. The chart in the right hand side showing that it was about 2 years ago, we saw $1 billion. Now it's $5.6 billion. It's rapidly growing. And this fund definitely will buy Korean equities. There's more demand for Korean equities. This is my last chart. I realized that this chart is wrong, that I asked my assistant to give me a chart for the last 10 years, but she gave me 1 year. I just realized that. For the last 10 years, that the last peak in Kaspi was about 1,000 in 89. So after 20 years, it's now 1,400. So it's not expensive market. It is a very cheap market. I have great confidence in Korean economy and stock market. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I particularly enjoyed your comments on Korea being a bridging culture between the West and China, which I think is quite fascinating. Now we move to institutional aspects, which are so important, and our next speaker will be Eric Jung, with the a partner at the law firm of White & Case.
Thank you. I'm the only lawyer in this distinguished group, and of course, ergo the techno-luddite, no PowerPoint presentation. So please bear with me. John, in his presentation, probably without intending to do so, set me up perfectly for the right segue to the topic that I want to focus on. Professor Schramm talked about going from macro to micro. We're drilling down to minuscule at this point. Two things in particular that I want to talk about is two things that John alluded to, growing or perceptibly growing anti-foreigner sentiment, and perhaps another perception that there is some backsliding or backpedaling going on in the government's reform or liberalization efforts. Just want to talk, look at a couple of commonly cited cases and then examine the veracity of that proposition. As all of you know, in the immediate aftermath of the Asian financial crisis of the 90s, Korean legal and regulatory regimes went through a phase of rapid and significant liberalization, resulting in, among other things, a near-complete opening of the Korean stock market for investors, and a complete or partial opening of nearly all service sectors to foreign competition, including commercial and investment banking, insurance, asset management, and accounting, law being one of the few closed service sectors in Korea today. Concurrently, the Korean corporate sector witnessed a series of governance reform measures, for instance, institutionalization of an outside director regime, and a passage of a legislative measure to assure independence of statutory directors, which had hitherto been rubber-stamp individuals or bodies. Last year, as again many observers I'm sure know, also saw a spirited proxy contest for KT&G, former Korea Tobacco and Ginseng, involving Warren Lichtenstein's steel partners and Carl Icahn. And we are now seeing movement and hearing pronouncements by some Korean domestic institutional investors, such as Mirae Asset Management, that have led some commentators to make a prediction, always a hazardous occupation, that Korean shareholder activism, domestic shareholder activism may soon become a reality. So generally speaking, certainly from the perspective of foreign investors looking at Korea, these are all very positive developments. At the same time, however, recent well-publicized Korean governmental actions have raised concerns in certain quarters as to whether the Korean government is now seeking to backpedal from its earlier reform measures. I will examine the soundness of this proposition by reviewing some recent legislative and regulatory measures that have been adopted or proposed in Korea and think about that a little bit. The two cases often cited in support of this backpedaling proposition, of course, are first the Lone Star case and the second the tax haven blacklisting promulgation of last summer. Let's look at those in order. Lone Star acquired the then-troubled Korea Exchange Bank a few years ago, and its subsequent effort to exit from that investment by selling to Kukmin Bank contracts entered into has been stalled largely in part to governmental actions against KEB, Korea Exchange Bank. And with respect to the tax haven, in July of last year, Korean National Tax Service, NTS, they don't use the term blacklisting, but it's commonly referred to as blacklisted one particular jurisdiction, Labuan, Malaysia, to be no longer eligible to the benefits of a longstanding tax treaty between Korea and Malaysia, and that has attracted a lot of attention. And to the extent what actually transpired may have been perceived. I want to talk about that a little bit before moving on to sort of the actual examination of the propositions. Korea Exchange Bank. After the onset of the crisis, financial crisis, KEB faced an asset quality problem like all the other Korean banks, resulting in a low risk-based capital ratio, received governmental bailout funding, and then the government in turn sold a controlling stake in the bank in an auction to Lone Star. So far, so good. Lone Star, a few years later, I guess 2 years ago, I don't know the exact dates in hand, but entered into a contract to sell its controlling stake to Kukmin Bank. What then transpired was that there was a criminal investigation looking into whether KEB's regulatory capital ratio, the Basel Accord ratio, BIS ratio, however you want to call it, had been manipulated, had been artificially lowered by the bank's then management, allegedly in collusion with Lone Star, in order to trigger a mandated bailout. In other words, there was a trigger that said if Korean bank's risk-based capital ratio fell below X percent, then it mandated a government takeover on the basis that it's no longer safe and sound within the banking system and had to be bailed out and then sold. And the allegation, of course, was that was engineered by insiders at the bank working with Lone Star. Now, as a lot of people, a lot of you know, that investigation followed periods of publicized brouhaha over foreigners making these obscene profits without paying a penny in taxes to boot, and then which would lead cynics and perhaps non-cynics to question the motive behind it. But setting aside the political subtext, speaking strictly as a lawyer, I think the heart of Lone Star KEB case is the legal and regulatory question. To what extent is the judgment of bank management in establishing loan loss provisions subject to retroactive regulatory scrutiny, especially when the allegation is that there was too much provisioning, not too little? Because obviously from the perspective of any banking regulator, Korean, Japanese, U.S., European, it is a good thing when bank management takes a very conservative approach and assume that the its non-performing loan portfolio may be at a higher risk than it actually may be. The more conservative, the better. Obviously, if you're more conservative, your loan provision is going to be higher. Therefore, in the immediate term, your capital is going to be more impaired. But obviously, that's precisely what the bank is accused of having done wrong 5-6 years after the fact. I think it does not bode well for Korea's continuing efforts to adopt the international best practice in this area, that management decision to take the bitter pill and set loan loss provisions, reserves at an upper end of the range, can later be subjected to civil and criminal sanctions. So that's sort of one backdrop. The tax haven blacklisting. Many foreign investors making equity investments in Korea favored Labuan, Malaysia, as the favored jurisdiction of incorporation for the actual vehicle that would make the acquisition into Korea, because the jurisdiction provided the benefits of the Korea-Malaysia tax treaty, under which the normal Korean withholding tax imposed on capital gains, lesser of 11% of gross proceeds or 27.5% of gains. Under normal circumstances, and in fact it had been the practice for a long time, that a qualifying Malaysian entity was exempt from Korean capital gains tax, withholding tax imposed on capital gains. And coupled with the fact that within Malaysia, which of course decidedly is not a tax haven jurisdiction, there is a tax haven enclave called Labuan, the beachhead. If Malaysian entity is incorporated in Labuan as an offshore company, in other words, it can be anything, anywhere in the world except in Labuan.
In Malaysia.
Then there was an alternative minimum tax imposed of 20,000-30,000 Malaysian ringgits, a few thousand US dollars, maybe even less. In July 2006, Korean tax authorities, NTS, promulgated a regulation that established a so-called look-through requirement, and this is the jargon, they didn't actually call it look-through, no more than they called it blacklisting. But with respect to foreign payees of Korean capital gains incorporated in these blacklisted jurisdictions, again, at the moment, although NTS reserved the right to do so, at the moment, the only entity listed on that list, only jurisdiction listed on that list is Labuan, Malaysia. Again, putting aside the underlying politics, whatever they may be, you can use your guess is as good as mine. As a legal and regulatory matter, the new rule essentially shifted the burden of proof in establishing whether the payee, the foreign investor, is the ultimate beneficial owner of the sum being paid. For entities from Labuan, the blacklisted jurisdiction, they must now establish that they are in fact the beneficial owner and not merely conduits. Whereas if you're from any other jurisdiction, still for the moment, the burden is still technically on the Korean NTS to establish that payee's not the beneficial owner. Now, some of the and I'd be happy to, we can talk at some length, but given the limited time, I'll just leave it at that. But some of the requisite documents that need to be furnished in this regard for Labuan entities are, for instance, tax returns for the preceding 3 years. If you can't establish that you are the ultimate beneficial owner, if you're a fund, you have to go to your limited partner, which itself may be an investment vehicle. Ultimately, you get to the top, whatever it may be, General Electric, Archer Daniels Midland Company. And in order to establish that they themselves have paid taxes in the U.S. and they should be exempt by virtue of the U.S.-Korea tax treaty, for instance, they have to furnish about 10 documents, one of which is tax return for the past 3 years, not something that is likely to be forthcoming easily, if ever. The most troubling policy question from a lawyer's perspective is this. The new rule applies even to vehicles and their investments that were in place before the new rule went into effect on July 1st, 2006, called ex post facto rulemaking. And I think that more than anything else, to the extent this rule stands, has the potential of doing some long-term damage to the reputation of Korea. Because I think it obviously raises issues of fairness and a fundamental question as to the rule of law. So those are some of the instances that have caused some concerns. Now, speaking of fairness, is it actually fair to say, in some metaphysical sense, that these cases represent a trend on the part of the Korean government? In other words, are they deliberately creating an environment that is less hospitable to foreign investors for political gain or some other reason? In this regard, I'll take a quick look at two recent developments. I'm not sure how I'm doing on time, but... Quickly, two recent developments. One is a set of fairly comprehensive amendments proposed for the Commercial Code, which is a principal corporate statute of Korea. These proposals represent a step forward in corporate governance. They were proposed by the Ministry of Justice in October of 2006. There's been a series of hearings, and it is anticipated that the amendment would be enacted sometime around June of this year, with one notable exception, which I shall get into presently. Some of the salient features of the corporate governance reform in this current round: strengthening of fiduciary duties of directors, specific prohibition of usurpation of corporate opportunity, meaning self-dealing by directors who are putting personal interests ahead of the companies. They now make it a specific provision in the Commercial Code and create a legal basis to prosecute that. Second, broaden the scope of affiliate transactions. Currently, individual directors propose transactions with a company on whose board he or she sits is subject to board approval. This reform measure would expand that to include require a prior approval not only for the director himself or herself, but the immediate family members, the spouse, immediate family members, and any company privately controlled by any of those people. Another one will just cut to this shortly, quickly, allowing electronic proxy voting, another practice that's not as commonplace in Korea as it perhaps ought to be, and there's a measure under proposal right now to facilitate that. Greater allowance of issuance of shares with restricted voting rights. I don't need to talk about that too much. Allowing in-kind distribution of dividends rather than just cash dividends, which has been an issue for a lot of foreign investors. So there's one element that was proposed. It's not going to pass, but I will skip that given the lack of time. So by and large, these are forward-looking developments in terms of enhancing accountability and transparency in corporate governance, and I think that's a good thing that they're doing. Second issue of the day, which will be my last point, however, is a bit more complex. Since 1982, Korea has had a separation of commerce from banking, much in the same way that the United States had one since 1956, the Bank Holding Company Act of 1956. Essentially, the rule is that non-financial operators, or large chaebols, may not own more than 4% of voting shares of a commercial bank. The limit is 10% for everyone else, including foreigners. And it's, again, others have pointed out that there are, half of the Korean banks are now controlled by foreigners. Kukmin Bank is 80% owned by foreign shareholders. Shinhan, I think, is the same thing. However, just in the last 2 weeks, somewhat troubling sign, Korean lawmakers from both the ruling party, the ruling party and the Grand National Party, have come out in support of repealing this 4% limit for chaebols. Now, what's interesting about the subtext of the current Korean debate is that debate seems to have little to do with the actual merits and demerits of a policy behind separating industry from banking, with the subsidy provided in the form of a deposit insurance and the special role that banks play in the economy, parts of a payment system and settlement process and so forth, and a debate that would all warm the heart of any banking lawyer. But instead, what the proponents of the repeal of the separation are saying is that their aim basically is to keep the ownership of Woori Bank and Industrial Bank of Korea, two banks that are still largely controlled by the Korean government, within Korean hands if and when they're privatized. In other words, the only way to find a viable domestic buyer of these banks and to keep them in Korean hands is to allow chaebols to get into the bank ownership business. And I guess one could say that old habits die hard. And also, obviously, you know, I keep putting aside political subtext, but obviously everyone knows that there, you know, there's a presidential election coming up in December in Korea and a general parliamentary election April of next year. And there perhaps is some connection there. On that note, I'd like to, I don't have a big bang of a conclusion, maybe a, just a whimper of an observation to note that it's not, I don't think it's entirely fair to say that the Korean government has been backpedaling in its near decade-old path of economic and regulatory realization. The record of late has been a mixed bag, but I think it would be unfair to say that there's been a complete reversal of sorts on this front during the current administration. And in my remarks with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Sounds like the makings of a business school case. Our next speaker will be Kaz Parsh, who is Senior Manager for International Tax Services at Ernst & Young.
Do you need a pointer or anything?
No, there's actually one typo I just found. Rather embarrassing, but anyways, Eric just talked about and sort of made taxing people a little blacker than they may be, but so I'll see how lighten up I could do for all the tax areas and tax issues. A lot of people think the tax, so-called tax issues are kind of dry, very dry. There is no humor in there. It's not really true. Otherwise, we aren't really going to survive. So, although I guess the tax issues probably made my hair gray. Anyways, when we talk about taxes, particularly for foreign investors going into Korean market, there are two very distinctive tax systems. One is called direct taxes. The other one is called indirect taxes. And I'm not going to go over each one of them that much, but income tax, withholding tax, these are what we call direct taxes. And both direct tax and indirect tax taxes are actually out-of-pocket expense for you. That's why tax issues are one of the biggest issues in doing business in anywhere in the world, including the U.S. And then that's where you, if you see or if you are told, well, this is what you have to pay, my first reaction is, where does it say? Who says that? Who's got the authority to say it? I'm not necessarily challenging it, but if something that doesn't say outright, you can't do it, my first reaction is, so we should be able to do it. Well, the government may challenge you because they didn't say it, but they may have intended to say it. But there's nothing that says you cannot do it, or if you do it, you're going to jail. If it doesn't say it, my first reaction, and especially as tax advisor to investors, is if the government doesn't say you cannot do it, chances are 50-50. Are you a risk taker or are you not a risk taker? It's important. Sometimes the government, it's not just Korea, it's basically worldwide, including the U.S. The reason I said that tax areas, particularly tax advising or tax consulting, are very interesting is because we have to be very creative. We really do have to be creative. And what I mean is when legislation comes out and it says in some way, well, this is the law, it doesn't tell you everything that they intend to say it. They may just squeeze into two phrases, two sentences. How would you know what the Congress intent, or how would you know what the Parliament's intent? You aren't there in the discussion. They just tell you, okay, this is the result. You just pay tax. Okay? but you didn't say, we can't do this, so can we do that? Until the government says, you can't do it, the way we look at it is, okay, maybe we have a chance to do it. If it is not outright illegal, like we're going to defraud the government because we are not going to pay tax, that's a different issue. There's a very fine line of tax planning and tax evasion. We're not talking about tax evasion. Tax planning itself is actually the planning is for the future on a going forward basis, not what actually happened in the past. That's already done. It's hard to go back and say, oh, sorry, I meant this. Can you just give us a break? That's a little hard to say. But for tax planning, there are a lot of rooms because it's everything is in the future. You don't know if there would be legislative changes. So you have to take it into account. There may be changes, but based on the current law and based on 3 years of forecast or your business plan, maybe this is what we can do. And then that's where we come in. So the purpose of tax people is to help you look into what business you can do, how well you can do, and how much money you can save. Now, saving tax money is not the same as, I repeat, evading tax payments. It's just you need to be pretty smart to see where you could really cut additional costs or the costs that are not necessary. The government did not tell you it's necessary. Then why should you be paying? I had some clients say, the client I noticed was paying huge tax amount. I said, why are you doing it? Well, so the tax authorities will just leave me alone. Well, that's not really the way because you may be wasting your money and you may be actually paying government for something that the government is not going to return. So you have extra money. Think about how you're going to invest in. Now, for tax areas, there are different ways of thinking about it. There are income tax exemptions. There are special concessionary rates, meaning these rates are lower than the statutory rates of 27.5%. Or some transactions can be completely exempt if you are setting up your businesses in a specialized area, what we call free trade zones or free economic zones. And so the way I look at it is foreign investors going into Korea really should know what tax incentives you qualify. These incentives are actually promoted and offered by the government. So you don't have to worry about hurting the government's feelings. Okay. Now, Eric just talked about a bit about the treaty, tax treaty, and the way Lone Star issues just came out. The treaty, the real purpose of the tax treaty is the two governments would agree to agree to let taxpayers take just one country's taxation and not being double taxed on the same amount. For example, I think a lot of people probably have some kind of investment somewhere. Let's say you receive interest income, let's say from Korea, and you're in the U.S. Now, Korea will tax that interest income that you receive when the payment is made. That's called withholding tax. That's the mechanism that they use so that you don't have to file tax returns in Korea. But that tax is withheld from your total payment. So your net cash is the net of that withholding tax. Okay. When that amount comes to you in the U.S., let's say you have $100, and the withholding tax is a little off percentage. It's actually 13.2, but because it's a little difficult to do the math, I'll do, let's say, just 10% flat out withholding tax. You as a taxpayer in the U.S., you can't just declare $90 as your U.S. taxable income. You have to declare $100, and then that tax is going to, that income is going to be taxed in the U.S. at 35%. So you say, gee, I already paid 10%, and I'm going to be assessed with another 35%. That's not fair. I'm actually paying 45% on the same income. What we do is then with that 35% of tax, let me say $35 of tax, is going to be reduced by the $10 of withholding tax that you've already paid. So your net U.S. tax is going to be $25. That's how the treaty works. And so the, using the treaty is, literally the purpose of the treaty is to avoid double taxation. And this is a government-to-government agreement. The U.S. and Korea treaty itself is a little old. We are hoping to get it up in speed because I think it was signed and entered into force probably in the mid-70s. And there are a lot more developments in that area. So, but Korea right now has approximately 60 income tax treaty partners. One of them, Eric talked about Malaysia. And there are other major countries, such as Netherlands, which has been Korea's most favorite countries until recently. And as he pointed out, with I will just jump over to the blacklist, is the, initially there are three other countries that were considered for as tax haven to be included in blacklist. And all three countries are currently, or at least the NTS and Korean government is seeking the amendment or renegotiation of the tax treaties with all three countries. And those are the Netherlands, Belgium, and Ireland.
Those all members of the EU, unlike Malaysia.
That's correct.
We've noticed.
But if you look at, you think about, it's Belgium, Netherlands, and Ireland. They're all very small countries. Very small, and they don't have the natural resources like other rich countries like the U.S. So why are they coming up on this? Because they are probably the world's most brilliant and creative countries when it comes to tax issues. And so what they did was they used so-called the treaty network to get the income, particularly capital gains, completely outside the Korean tax regime. When that capital gains income is actually pushed up to, let's say, Netherlands. Netherlands has, under its own tax regime, that amount is not taxed in Netherlands. So let's say I buy stock of a depressed entity. I say I paid $10. Some years later, I'm going to sell. I would sell at $10 million. That differential is capital gain. If I were a Netherlands entity and the company, the share, is the Korean share, I get scot-free. I don't get taxed on that differential. $10 million minus $10. It's all non-taxable in Korea. and I'm a Netherlands resident. I go home, that amount is never taxed in the Netherlands. So that's where the MTS really saw the issue. The Belgium is the same way. Ireland is the same way. These are called territorial tax areas. So that's why they use their own system and they use the treaty network to get a lot of amounts completely tax-free from both ends. And then that's what they thought it was abusive. And now they're really looking into changing this type of practices called anti-treaty shopping. You hop around and see which district or the jurisdiction is the best country to get to reroute all income tax-free from bottom to the top. Okay. That's called anti-treaty shopping. So what the government requires right now is economic substance and business purposes. How do you prove it? Not easy, because we have not received any kind of specific guidelines. So what do you mean by economic substance? What substance do you need to put? Do you have people in the foreign company? What kind of people do they have? Do they have clerks? Do they have people who just answer the calls? Or do they have some people with the management seat? The heavier the people's positions are, the better to have economic substance. Do they have, what kind of activities, business activities do they have? Do they sell? Do they provide services? Do they manage other companies? Or do they just sit there and collect dividends from bottom up? Those are type of stuff that we are looking at, or the government is looking for. And on top of it, what we call beneficial owner of income. This concept is now spreading all over Asia. It's not just Korea. It's basically going very rapidly. So if you don't have substance in the entity that is supposed to be holding you, the Korean company, we look up, because if, let's say, $10 million of dividends coming from Korea to this entity, well, this entity just turns around and push it over to another shareholder. It's not really utilized by this entity. It's called conduit. So that's what the government is looking. Say, well, if you have this kind of structure, then even though you have a treaty, we are going to put a lot more pressure and scrutinize. The burden of proof right now rests with the taxpayer, but you know all the tax authorities. They have the right to examine your books and records and tax returns and everything. So once you get hit with that, they're free to request all information. But this is not Korea is probably third or fourth country that actually finally adopted this concept to protect herself and her own economy. So as I said before, the treaty renegotiation is currently going on with those three countries topping it. The U.S., so far, U.S. side, the U.S. government has kind of hinted that the U.S. also would like to put Korea on the table. We have not seen it coming out yet. Korea side has not moved to going for the treaty renegotiation with the U.S. yet. So right now, these three are the top countries. Other things, when we have cross-border transactions, particularly with so-called intercompany transactions, and then this is the hottest area, because for a lot of tax authorities, this is probably one of the quickest ways to raise their revenues. They can assess very large penalties, because all it does is that, how are you going to prove that you prices. Let's say you have sales. You purchase goods from U.S. parent. Korean government will say, how are you going to substantiate the purchase price is at arm's length, that any third party will buy it? The presumption for every single intercompany transaction is that the prices are not arm's length. So you have to prove one way or the other. How are you going to do it? Generally, you have to hire us or some other people, a reputable firm, to do very thorough study and then substantiate with all the documentations and convince the government that this taxpayer or you as a taxpayer is complying with all the rules and regulations in Korea. And our prices are fair prices that we can say any third party willing purchasers would also pay for the goods. So that's what you have to do. There are ways to kind of enter into a special long-term agreement with the government. And for this, it's almost a security insurance that the government will not go in and examine your books and records and will not assess any penalties if there should be adjustments. But that's an option. Sometimes we basically tell them it is beneficial for them. Sometimes it may not be beneficial for you. It all depends on your current conditions. Other ways to try to get what the government's intent may be is called ruling request. This is something that there are two ways of doing. You can go through the official route. If you do that, you will get the written response from the government saying, okay, we've examined and reviewed your transactions. This is how we interpret the transactions, and this is how you're going to be taxed in Korea. Once that comes out, even you disagree with the position, you're stuck. The other way is unofficial. That you can conceal your name, identity, and just go, hello, can I talk to someone? I just hit this problem. You could actually do that, either on your own, or you could just have us represent you, but we will not reveal taxpayers' names. That's an official, what we call no-name basis. Okay. Where the Korean tax authorities are currently going? The NTS has been studying the global tax systems in different countries, and they are sending their delegates all over. In the U.S., not only that they have the delegates coming in and really stationed here, but they also send some of the top executives every year in New York. And as a matter of fact, we're the one educating, so we can't really say a whole lot about tax planning, because they may just think, aha, if we see U.S. companies coming into Korea, we'll just find these things. So we have to be careful. But actually, what they're doing is they're studying the U.S. tax system, and they try to adopt not only the U.S., but other major countries' tax system to try to adopt that kind of system into their own regime. For example, partnership concept, which doesn't exist in Korea. Consolidation doesn't exist in Korea. But the government is really looking at these areas so that they will be a lot more at par with their partners in other countries. And also, this type of structure will probably provide a lot more flexibilities for Korean domestic entities, as well as possibly some of the Korean individuals. So with that think the boring tax issues are over.
Well, thank you, our distinguished panelists, Donald, John, Eric, and Kaz. So let's have a round of applause for all of them. And I think now we could open it up to questions and entertain a few questions. Yes.
Sure. The currency appreciation and the article in the journal today about the free trade agreement going on and negotiations between the United States and Korea. Mm-hmm. Touched on the evolution of the Korean economy in terms of state support of industrialization in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. Talked about state support of certain agricultural products and pronounced state support of the automobile industry. Could you talk about where you see the agreement going in terms of when we might see it, what you see being the central tenets of it, and how it might affect the market when it does come out?
We actually have a group in Washington that tracks the negotiations that are ongoing, not just in the Korean FTA, but also in Peru and the Ecuador one's on hold, but there's another one, Panama. With Korea, there's two sets of issues. From the U.S. business community, the concern at the moment is about where you have recourse if you've got an investment. Do you have recourse outside of Korea? And there's some language in there that's creating concerns about that essentially they would, rather than being able to go to arbitration outside, you'd have to settle the issues within the Korean system, which is generating some angst in the U.S. side. In fact, there was an article today, I think, from Chevron that was complaining about this, given some of their, I believe, refining interests that they have in Korea. From the Korean standpoint, there's also issues. You actually have some Korean lawmakers who have gone on hunger strike, I believe yesterday or the day before, over the issue of the FTA. There's a deadline, I believe, of the end of the month to get this done. There's actually the deputy head of the USTR is in Seoul right now trying to finalize it. My personal view is that will be hard to do, given the political opposition at the moment, as well as the general view with regard to trade in the United States, particularly in the face of this opposition over the question of legal jurisdiction on investment, at least in the very short term. The levels of tariffs that one has in the United States on most Korean products and vice versa aren't particularly high, so the economic consequences of this are not especially large, I would argue. You made mention of the questions of government support. One of the things that's actually changed in Korea, by and large, is the level of direct support that you have for industry, quite dramatically, in fact. And in terms of government support, I don't think we want to put U.S. policy up against the support we provide to U.S. agriculture to that which we provide in Korea. I mean, we have to be a little careful about pots and kettles. And with regard to the auto industry, there's certainly today there's no reason for the U.S. for the Korean government to need to support the Korean automobile industry. And in fact, the Korean government was quite brutal in the handling of Daewoo, for example, and was perfectly happy to sell Daewoo to GM at the period in which they were making an effort to restructure Chaebol in the 1997-98 period. So I don't think there's issues of kind of implicit subsidies or other things that are advantaging Korean industry over other competitors by and large. I do think the issues that Eric was bringing up about the questions of law and how you settle issues are a serious issue going forward. There is another point an important one in thinking about an investment that goes a little bit beyond the FTA, and that's something that we've come across in our own operations in Korea, which is Korea tends to actually have what's called operate with positive lists, not negative lists. In other words, unless it's specifically allowed, it's illegal. And yet when you actually find, in the financial industry in particular, there's many activities that go on a day-to-day basis which are not explicitly sanctioned, which leaves you then at the mercy of regulators, which is one of these issues surrounding why you want to be able to have recourse outside. And that creates a level of business risk that can be complicated, because if you don't operate in, if you don't engage in those activities, you're at a competitive disadvantage from others who do, right? And yet, if you do, you're essentially exposing yourself to intervention by the authorities whenever they decide that they want to go after you, for whatever reason that may be. So that's a level of uncertainty that over time needs to be dealt with.
Thank you. More questions? Yes.
I have a question to direct more to John. During your presentation, you mentioned about the backlash of foreign ownership.
Excuse me. About foreign ownership of Korean companies and stocks and so forth. Now, if I recall my figures are correctly, 2004, I believe, was the highest level of foreign ownership of Korean KOSPI and KOSDAQ stocks at about 40%. And it's certainly fallen from that. I think the last figure is hovering around 35% or so. I mean, do you attribute to that or to the actual backlash or perhaps the market conditions, downturn in market conditions? And, you know, I wanted to get your thoughts on it. And perhaps Don may have some thoughts on that from an economic perspective.
I think it is more to do with the market condition that that foreign investors that had some other alternatives investing outside of Korea, like India, other hard market, China. So I think there's more to do with it. In terms of the anti-foreign ownership culture, as long as you don't make money, that's fine. So they expect you lose money, then you're welcome. So that, I think that's danger. That the especially individuals, that the one of the things that they're going after, Lone Star, is, I don't know the legal, you know, the details. If they could have made some criminal act, I don't know. But if they lost money, it couldn't be an issue. So that's really dangerous thinking, that to simplify the foreign investment. So I think the government has to do a lot of job to educate people that foreign money is really needed for Korea's development. But that the media is all the media is somehow not sophisticated and not guiding the people in the wrong direction to some extent, and then very emotional, and all the difficulties by foreign, you know, Koreans having now is all because of the foreign, you know, investors making too much money. They don't see the real problem in Korea facing. You know, they have to be more direct that what has to be done, and the corporate governance is the one big factor that they have to improve on. The chaebol issue is also the things that they have to improve on. But it's unfortunately that the attention is focusing on foreign investors.
Okay. I could follow up. There's also, I believe, probably, you have to go back a little earlier. If you look at Korea's history, one of the things that's interesting in the growth of the economy, which over time has been quite spectacular, it was largely funded by Korean savings, not by foreign direct investment. The shares were actually quite low. And it peaked just in the couple of years after the crisis, in which you had purchases, for example, as I had already mentioned, of Daewoo by GM, Daewoo Auto. After that brief flourishing of the acquisition of assets during that period of time, subsequently the actual levels of foreign direct investment as a share of overall physical investment or real investment, as economists would call it, as opposed to financial, has gone back down again. I think one of the issues with regard to the investments, for example, of Newbridge or Lone Star, and this is not unique to Korea, is that when you go back and things have actually turned out good, any investment is going to look like you got it at a cheap price, right? It's very different when you do the assessment in the moment. There were lots of criticisms. I recall when the bids went out for those loans that the winning bids looked quite high at the time, given people's expectations. And so while leave aside the questions of taxation and how it was structured, the idea that when one looks back in time and things have gone well, everything looks like it was sold cheap. Of course it does, right? But that's because things went well. Thank goodness. And in part, things may have gone well because you sold them, because there was a restructuring that allowed credit to flow again, that allowed business to grow. Yeah. And so in that sense, I think there's a bias that naturally creeps in that makes it look like things were sold cheaply to whoever happened to buy them. And if they then don't pay taxes, that, of course, only exacerbates the sense of something being sold cheap.
Yes. Go ahead.
The question is for John or Don. How do you compare the political risk of investing in Korea versus the other Northeast Asian countries?
You want to start? Do you invest elsewhere?
No, but they mean the political issues, meaning the North Korea or?
Yeah, just.
Yeah, I mean, Korea has been living in that situation for many, many years. I don't think that particularly this time the Korea is more dangerous or dangerous place investing. I'm cautiously optimistic that in terms of North Korea relations, that actually one of my analysts went to North Korea doing the company visits. That's a big progress that, you know, no one could think of that can happen. Actually, when I was running the Korea Fund, whenever there's any negative news out of Korea, North Korea, they're always buying time. I don't particularly get concerned about the North Korea, but I do concerned about the sudden collapse of North Korea. That could be the medium-term, you know, hiccup for Korean economy. So I think that nobody wants that to happen. So South Korean government is involved. China is involved. So I think that overall, I'm probably too optimistic, but I'm a little bit not too worried about North Korea political matter.
My sense is, on the question of North Korea, if you talk to most South Koreans, it's sort of existential. I mean, in the sense that because the border is very close, and because of the number of howitzers that are pointed at South Korea, yeah. In a matter, and leave aside the missiles that could take out the existing ones that they have that could take out 75% of the trade, which goes to one port, right in the south, in Busan. In a matter of a week, you could essentially reduce if you got into a battle, you'd reduce the South Korean economy to rubble, right? And particularly given that, if I remember, 2/3 of all economic activity is within in the provinces that border North Korea, in South Korea. So if you were worried about an attack, you wouldn't be there. So you sort of have the selection bias. If you're there, it just can't be an issue, right? You've made that decision, all right? Now, there's a second set of issues, which is, okay, well, how likely is something, you know, untoward going to occur in North Korea? I would discount, first of all, that they would ever spontaneously attack because they're crazy. They're not, actually. The North Korean actions are always, I think, actually quite calculated. And there's a whole series of game theory that I can go through that you probably don't want to hear in the short answer. But the sense of a sort of risky attack because of silly decisions in North Korea, I think, is extremely low. And that then leaves the question of, well, what about poor policies leading to an economic collapse? And that's where I think that the attitude of the sunshine policy is actually quite sensible, because one of the things you want to do is actually engage in an effort to try and avoid that very collapse. There's also people who talk about, well, what about the kind of issues that went on with the integration of East Germany into West Germany and the economic burden that created? And I would pose the other example that's out there, which what about the integration of Hong Kong with Shenzhen, with the Guangdong province, yeah, which has occurred in a fashion that where you saw strong growth in both sides of the border, and the difference, of course, being that nobody had tried to impose the same exchange rate in both parts, and the border remained closed. Yeah. So with that, you can have a policy of adjustment that takes a number of years and is far less cataclysmic or far less consequential economically. I think also the fact that South Korea is enlisting the support and capital of Japan, Russia, and the United States also makes the issue of the ultimate expansion of the North Korean economy a much more manageable process. In terms of political risks in Korea relative to, say, China, you're going to have cataclysmic risks in both places, and day-to-day risks are relatively low in both places. The issues in China are about the how it is that one marries a system that is politically quite central, centralist, right, and monolithic, with an economic structure that's increasingly individually based and decentralized. That creates a level of risk that's important. There's also the same issue we've been talking about, the suppressions of nationalism within Korea. There's the same issue in China, yeah? There's another important private investor, Carlyle, that's engaged in issues in an investment he's trying to do with a machine tool company in China, because suddenly the machine tool company has gotten bureaucrats to say this is a nationally strategic industry. Okay. And you've got issues associated with Chinese nationalism and the attitudes vis-a-vis Taiwan or vis-a-vis Japan, which are at one level not really rational, right? These are emotional responses that can have an element of unpredictability that is that one simply has to deal with, frankly. And that's where, at least by talking, which is what's going on with the Chinese and the Japanese, with the North Koreans and others, is an important positive sign for the region overall.
Yes.
Donald, John, Eric, pause it. You can think about this one if it's worth thinking about. But with the banking. Scandal, the Lone Star scandal. Banking seems to be more complex than going in and taking over other categories of industry or capitalism. Are there certain areas, I mean, in the sense that banking is involved in all different kinds of industry, any given bank is in of itself, but are there certain categories of industry, for instance, the power plants, where Korea would so much like to get its hands on overseas technologies that it would relax tax structures, or where politics would take a back seat. It would become very open just to get foreign investment in certain areas, i.e. Power plants, water purification, or in that sense, are there good areas to that if you were a U.S. company, you'd want to focus on those companies as targets to involve yourself with, either as a minority stakeholder or a 51% plus stakeholder.
I don't have a strong view on the issues of which industries might be politically less sensitive. I would argue that with the banks, that there is a... Let's see. One of the things that has changed is in general, across a number of countries, is a willingness to allow greater degrees of foreign participation. It's a little easier if you create an environment in which credit is going to be given on the basis of the credit worthiness of the borrower, as opposed to on the basis of a set of either personal relationships or by telephone. Or on the basis of government decree, yeah? And that is one of the things there's far less government involvement in credit allocation, and hence the necessity to have a local owner who you can more easily control has diminished, yeah? And hence I think the issues that surround Lone Star and KB have more to do with what I said earlier, which is, well, it now looks like it was a cheap investment because things went well, yeah? And that can happen in a variety of businesses, and this just happens to be one, because banks are prominent in the economy, that gets attention. But if you made a lot of money in a chip plant, yeah, for example, in investments in Hyundai or some of the other businesses that were spun off and took it all out in profits, you would, I think, be getting the same scrutiny from the NTS uh, that uh, that some of those who invested in the banks are getting.
Just to add a minute to that, I mean, I think the I'm not qualified to address the desirability of investing in one industry as opposed to another, but as you know, I mean, the you know, there's a lot of countries, including the United States, we have what one might call a love-hate relationship between the government regulators and the banks. You know, a great deal of Andrew Jackson was very suspicious of banks, as you all know. And many subsequent presidents have been as well. And banks, you know, occupy a special place in the regulatory regime in many places because of, for instance, a lot of countries have deposit insurance, explicit guarantee of the U.S. federal government behind their fundraising efforts. Korea has a deposit insurance system as well, although not to the extent that they exist in this country. The fact that they play a crucial role in the payments and settlement system, it is generally deemed that, that because of those traits, they're not just any old commercial enterprises. They require some additional regulatory strictures and an oversight from the government. And for those perhaps very reasons, and the fact that obviously it's a very convenient means to access a capital, a lot of industrial owners in Korea and elsewhere have always coveted bank ownership, and there are specific restrictions that aim at industrial, you know, marriages with banks. So, I'm not, you know, just an observation. I'm not sure that I'm directly answering your question, but
there are countries like New Zealand who basically say better to have foreign owners because then when they come knocking at their door, you know, we don't have to bail them out. They can, right? Honestly, it's actually an explicit strategy on the part of the New Zealanders to let Aussies own their banks. So there are benefits to actually having foreign participation, but that's on the assumption that the New Zealanders make that, look, the banks have an interest in trying to be profitable, and we're not there trying to direct their credit to any particular local entity, right? And to the extent that you're concerned about the ownership, you're implicitly concerned that about trying to influence where that credit goes. Leave aside the questions that Aaron brought up about the importance of banks as intermediaries and the potential to distort the use of deposit insurance.
So maybe we'll have one more question. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. John, go ahead.
I don't think there are any the government policies favoring foreign investment in certain area comparing to others. I think more of the issue of regulators depending on the industry. And usually the government officials they're trying to protect local business owners against the foreign competitors. They have fear of being taken over by more competitive foreign players coming in. For example, that asset management license, the Korean law says that they will welcome all the foreign investment, but actually giving out the license, they are very reluctant to giving out the license, something like that. But all the working level people, they are very nationalistic. They have an obligation to protect local against the foreign competitors.
Okay, maybe we have, yes.
I just want to ask, what is the likely means in which activist investing is going to occur in Korea? I mean, we have the closest model would be Japan, but obviously, if you look at Japan and Korean management styles, Koreans are much more, we are much more open to confrontation than Japanese are. So what's the likelihood of, you know, using, especially considering the nationalist you know, backlash that's been going on recently against foreign owners, is it most likely to be domestic activist investors, or is it going to be a partnership between foreign and domestic, or is it going to be foreigners because of the experience of foreign investors in the areas of corporate governance?
Well, depending on how you are perceived by the market, we launched the fund, the corporate governance fund, a year ago. That clearly that our perception from the market is different than ICANN or other the activist players because of We are telling the market that we are long-term investor. We're not leaving the market. We like Korea. We have individuals in Korea for many, many years. So we are trying to protect, you know, project that our image. But the local people, individuals, are they much more sophisticated what the big media says, that they virtually know that somebody has to do to activate that all the legal leverage we have as a shareholder, that the Korea, that they had a great job in terms of law and regulations changes, but implementing is still, there are a long way to go, and that there are clearly big issues in corporate governance in small, large, and big, anywhere, the Korean government is trying to improve on that issue, but the shareholders should be more active improving it. There's some resentment from some people, especially from media, but I don't think that Korea will go back to old good days, that they know that that has to be done at the even if it's by the foreigners or by anyone. They accept the fact that somebody, as a shareholder, every shareholder has the same right. There's kind of a understanding. Unfortunate case is ICANN and KT&G. KT&G was rated as the best corporate governance company in Korea. So it was difficult to convince Korean people that really true intention is ICANN is to really improve corporate governance or using corporate governance to maximize the return, especially short-term return. But overall, that Koreans are they accept the fact that as a shareholder, all the shareholders have the same right to raise voice, and that has been improving more recently in the shareholder meetings. So some individuals they raise voices that there has been that more people are more active in improving corporate governance. And there'll be the issues for the coming years, that especially the last year, that actually I was in Korea last month and until most of this month attending the shareholder meeting. All the TV stations are following us in the shareholder meeting. So this is something that Korea has to take very serious.
Okay, yes, Eric?
30-second footnote, as you can probably tell from my body language, I've been chomping at the bit to say this part, one of my favorite nuggets, actually. First of all, I'm not sure, John, that every Korean chaebol chieftain got the memo that minority shareholders have the same rights. I didn't say that. At the center of the KT&G battle, with the Steel Partners and Carl Icahn was cumulative voting, of course. The rule in Korea is for a listed company, 1% shareholder can request cumulative voting at the next shareholders meeting to elect shareholders. Everyone knows what cumulative voting is, so I won't get into that, unless the charter document provides otherwise. This rule came into being in 1998. We all know what was happening in Korea in 1998. When cumulative voting was instituted as part of the code, the legislature put in a 6-month delay in effective date. And what happened was, at the time, there were 587 listed companies. Of the 587, 499, some 85%, rushed to amend the Articles of Incorporation to disallow cumulative voting. I guess last year when I checked, some 94% of listed Korean companies have a provision in the Articles of Incorporation that disallow cumulative voting. Now, one interesting anecdote to that, footnote to that is, a shareholder can also request a vote to restore cumulative voting to the extent, you're a shareholder in one of these 94% of the companies that have, disallowed them. And in that situation, any shareholder that owns more than 3% of outstanding shares, any excess over 3%
is disenfranchised. In other words, if you own 40% of a company or a family owner, and then this shareholder proposal to restore cumulative voting is put to a vote, your 40% is actually only worth 3% for that particular vote, which is actually a very interesting provision. Hasn't yet been tested in a very public way, but sort of in follow-up to your question, it remains to be seen. I mean, you know, obviously cumulative voting hasn't always proven to be an effective weapon in either offense or defense in across the board, but certainly in Korea, that's something that we're keeping a close tab on.
Yes, there's one very last question.
What are your views of Korean mutual insurance company conversions, and what are the similarities and differences between a Korean mutual insurance company and a U.S. mutual insurance company in the conversion process?
I'm not an expert in the insurance sector, especially the Korean insurance companies. There's a lot of debate going on that whether that all the profits made should be the policyholders or that the management. I don't have any particular view on that because I'm not a I'm not an expert in the insurance sector, but I hear all different views from that the government people or insurance people, and I don't know that how it's different than other countries, so I have to look into it. I don't. Do you have any idea?
No clue.
Okay. I think there are a big change in the insurance industry. Not necessarily from tax point of view, but there have been a lot of foreign insurance companies going into Korea, and either partnering with the local Korean insurance companies or what we call swapping policies and insuring or insuring each other for the insurance risks. So those are kind of changing markets in the insurance company. And this is not really very typical. Well, it's not really just for Korea. A lot of Asian insurance company areas, most of them started with the local base and had just the basic insurances such as fire, marine, life insurance, auto, that type of stuff. Now, insurance companies, you know, most of the insurance companies make money by investing into something else. And so the way they look at is the policyholders also should have a say in how the insurance companies operate. And I think because of the government or because the way the global economy is going in a lot of insurance industries, the insurance companies are also required to be a little more transparent to the policyholders. So the changes, big changes I have seen in the last several years is the swapping of policies or reinsuring each other's not related parties. It's just trying to segregate their diversified portfolio into a little more streamlined and manageable way. That's how they're going to, it's not really trading the policies, but insuring each other's. So that's kind of a current trend.
Okay. Once again, thank you, Evans and Patrick of the Korea Society, Heidi Thompson and Paulina Yick from the Columbia Business School Asian Alumni Association, Bonnie Graziano and Merrill Lynch, and, of course, the very great views expressed by the distinguished panel this evening. Thank you all.
Folks, we've run a little over. Sorry about that. But we hope you will stay, and there's the speakers gave us extra wisdom this evening, so please stay and discuss these ideas over food and drink. Thank you.
The opinions expressed at this forum do not necessarily reflect those of the Korea Society. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Quarterly. Memberships may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.
The proceeding was a production of the Korea Society. For more information on our programs, please visit www.koreasociety.org.